A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about Rugrats, that 90s Nickelodeon staple we all grew up with. And his question is basically, why does it feel so vanilla in retrospect? He says, unlike shows that genuinely unsettled him, like Rosie and Jim or the Morbegs, Rugrats just feels familiar but lackluster. Was it the characters? What made it unappealing even though he played the game version and got into it? There's a real question here about why some children's shows leave a deep impression and others just sort of evaporate.
This is actually a much more interesting question than it sounds on the surface, because Rugrats was Nickelodeon's longest-running original series at the time. It ran from 1991 to 2004 and then got revived. It was a commercial juggernaut. And yet, I completely get what the prompt is pointing at. There's a hollowness there. It's the beige wallpaper of 90s animation.
The musical equivalent of a waiting room.
And that's worth unpacking because it wasn't an accident. Rugrats was designed to be exactly what it was. The question is why that design choice leaves some viewers feeling nothing, while something like the Morbegs sears itself into your memory.
Let's start with what Rugrats actually was, structurally, because I think the design choices explain a lot of the vanilla feeling.
Rugrats premiered in 1991, created by Arlene Klasky, Gabor Supo, and Paul Germain. The core premise is that the show is seen from the baby's perspective. Tommy Pickles, Chucky Finster, and the twins Phil and Lil, later joined by Angelica, who's 3 years old and the antagonist, and eventually Tommy's little brother Dill and Chucky's stepsister Kimmy. The adults are these giant, vague presences who misunderstand everything the babies are doing.
The babies can talk to each other, but the adults can't understand them.
It's a conceit that lets the show operate on two levels. The babies have full conversations, the adults hear babbling. That's clever on paper. The problem is what they do with it.
Which is what, exactly?
Mostly very safe, very repetitive adventure plots. The babies wander off, get into mild peril, misunderstand something about the adult world, and resolve it by the end of the episode. There's very little that lingers. Compare that to something like the Morbegs, which the prop mentions. That show had an elemental weirdness. A burning tree, a castle, these ancient mythic beings. It wasn't just narratively strange, it was visually and atmospherically strange. Rugrats, by contrast, has a very consistent house style that is, frankly, kind of ugly.
The Klasky-Cisipo house style.
Arlene Klasky and Gabor Supo founded their animation studio in 1982. They did the early Simpsons shorts on the Tracy Ullman show, and you can see the DNA. Everything is slightly off-kilter, angular, with these thick outlines and deliberately crude proportions. The characters in Rugrats have asymmetrical eyes, weird head shapes, strained body proportions. It's an aesthetic of intentional ugliness.
Which is not automatically a criticism. Ugly can be memorable. The Morbegs were not conventionally beautiful.
No, but the Morbegs had a coherent aesthetic vision that served the story. The ugliness in the Morbegs was unsettling in a way that matched the folkloric tone. The ugliness in Rugrats is just, it doesn't serve a mood. It's the default Klasky-Cisipo look, applied to a show about babies. It's the glockenspiel of corporate approachability. It's meant to signal quirkiness without actually being quirky.
That's a good distinction, signal versus substance. So the look was doing quirkiness, as branding, but the actual content underneath wasn't strange at all.
And this gets to a broader point about 90s children's television. Nickelodeon in the early 90s had three original animated shows that launched the Nicktoons brand, Doug, Rugrats, and Ren and Stimpy. Those three shows represent a spectrum. Doug was gentle, observational, low stakes. Ren and Stimpy was deliberately grotesque, subversive, and pushed boundaries constantly, so much so that creator John Kricfalusi was eventually fired from his own show. Rugrats sat right in the middle. It had the weird visual style, but none of the subversion.
It was the safe option that looked like the risky option.
And that's the core of the vanilla problem. Rugrats borrowed the aesthetic language of weirdness without any of the weirdness itself. It's vaporwave for toddlers, the signifiers of strangeness with none of the substance.
That's a take. So let's talk about the characters, because the prompt specifically asks whether it was the characters that made it feel lackluster.
Tommy Pickles is the brave leader. Chucky is the anxious sidekick. Phil and Lil are the gross-out twins. Angelica is the bully. These are archetypes so broad they could fit into any children's show ever made. There's nothing wrong with archetypes. Most great children's entertainment uses them. But great shows do something with the archetype. They complicate it, or push it to an extreme, or subvert it.
Angelica is probably the most interesting character, right?
She is. And I think that's because she's the only character with genuine internal conflict. She's 3 years old, she's no longer a baby, she's navigating this liminal space between the baby world and the adult world, and she's often quite lonely. There's an episode where she has a nightmare about her parents having a new baby and abandoning her. That's real psychological territory. But the show mostly uses her as a plot device. She shows up, creates a problem by being selfish, and either gets comeuppance or learns a lesson by the end. The deeper stuff is gestured at, but never really explored.
Which is the whole show, really. It gestures a depth without ever committing to it.
And the babies themselves, Tommy, Chucky, Phil, Lil, their one note. Tommy is brave, Chucky is scared, the twins are interchangeable and obsessed with gross things. That's it. Over 170 episodes, they don't evolve much. There are moments, Chucky gets a new mom, Tommy gets a little brother, but the show immediately snaps back to the status quo.
The status quo is sacred in children's television. That's not unique to Rugrats.
It's not. But great children's shows find ways to evolve characters within the status quo. Look at something like Hey Arnold, which came a few years later. Arnold doesn't fundamentally change, but the show deepens your understanding of him. You learn about his missing parents, his relationship with his grandparents, his weirdly mature worldview. The world of Hey Arnold feels lived in and specific. The world of Rugrats feels like a set that gets reset at the end of every episode.
The characters are archetypes without depth, deployed in a world without texture. That's a recipe for forgettable television. But it was enormously popular, so something was working.
Rugrats was a ratings monster. At its peak in the mid-90s, it was the highest-rated children's show on television. It spawned 3 feature films, the first of which. The Rugrats movie in 1998 made over $140 million worldwide against a budget of about $24 million. That's a genuine blockbuster. The show was nominated for multiple Emmys and actually won a few daytime Emmys. This was not a niche thing. This was a cultural institution.
We have a show that was massively commercially successful, critically recognized to some degree, but feels hollow to a lot of people who grew up with it. That's an interesting tension.
And I think part of the answer is that Rugrats succeeded despite its creative limitations, not because of some hidden depth we're all missing. It succeeded because it hit a very specific demographic sweet spot at exactly the right moment. Rugrats premiered in 1991, right as the children's television market was expanding dramatically. Cable was in more homes, Nickelodeon was investing heavily in original programming, and there was a growing appetite for shows that parents could watch with their kids. Rugrats was perfect for that. It was inoffensive enough that parents wouldn't object, but had just enough edge, the visual style, the occasional gross-out humor, that kids felt like they were watching something a little bit naughty.
The illusion of edge.
And the baby premise was genius from a marketing perspective. Babies are universally appealing. Every child was a baby. Every parent remembers their child as a baby. The show could sell plush toys, diapers, baby products. The merchandising was massive. By 1998, Rugrats toys and products were generating over $1 billion in retail sales annually.
$1 billion.
This show was a commercial machine. And I think that's part of the vanilla feeling in retrospect. When something is that optimized for mass appeal, it sands off the edges that make art memorable. It's the difference between a handmade chair and an IKEA chair. The IKEA chair is fine. Billions of people sit on them. But nobody has strong feelings about an IKEA chair.
Build me a chair nobody notices they're sitting in.
That's exactly what Rugrats was, and it was very good at being that chair.
The prompt also mentions the game version. Daniel says he became a big fan of the game. I think that's worth talking about, because the Rugrats video games were a whole parallel universe.
There were a lot of them. The most notable is probably Rugrats Search for Reptar, which came out for the PlayStation in 1998. It was developed by a company called Nspace and published by THQ. And here's the thing, it was actually pretty good for a licensed game. It had the babies wandering through levels based on episodes of the show, collecting items, solving simple puzzles. The levels were literal interpretations of the babies' imaginations. A toy store becomes a massive labyrinth, the backyard becomes a jungle.
The game version may have been more interesting than the show itself.
That's a real argument. In the game, you're actively participating in the baby's perspective. The world is strange and oversized because you're experiencing it through their eyes, and you have agency. You're exploring. The show tells you what the babies are thinking, but the game makes you think like a baby. That's a fundamentally more immersive experience.
That might explain why someone could be a big fan of the game while finding the show lackluster. The game delivered on the premise in a way the show didn't.
The show tells you the babies have rich inner lives, but what you actually see is fairly thin. The game gives you a world that feels different because of the baby perspective, and lets you inhabit it. There's also Rugrats, Studio Tour, Rugrats in Paris, the movie game, and a handful of Game Boy titles. The Game Boy ones were mostly basic platformers, but Search for Reptar on PlayStation had genuine ambition.
Were there any games that were strange or unsettling?
There's a weird one. Rugrats, Totally Angelica, which was a Game Boy Color game from 2000, where you play as Angelica in her own fantasy world. It's a fashion-themed game, basically, but Angelica's fantasy sequences are kind of unhinged. She imagines herself as a movie star, a superhero, a princess. It's all very girly and pink, but there's an undercurrent of desperation to it. Angelica's need for attention and validation is so naked that the game becomes almost uncomfortable to play.
That's more psychologically interesting than anything in 170 episodes of the show.
It really is, and I think that gets at something important about Rugrats as a franchise. The premise, seeing the world from a baby's perspective, with all the misunderstanding and imagination that implies, is rich. But the show rarely mined that richness. The games, freed from the constraints of 11-minute episodic television, could sometimes go to weirder places.
Let's talk about the adult perspective on Rugrats, because there's a whole genre of internet theory about the show being secretly dark.
Oh, the dark Rugrats theories. There's the famous one that all the babies are figments of Angelica's imagination. Tommy is stillborn, Chucky died in a car accident with his mother, Phil and Lil are aborted fetuses. Angelica invents them all to cope with her neglectful parents.
Which is complete nonsense, obviously.
The creator, Paul Germain, has explicitly debunked it. But the fact that this theory gained so much traction tells you something. People wanted Rugrats to be more interesting than it was. They projected depth onto it because the surface was so bland that they assumed there must be something underneath.
Like seeing shapes in static.
The show was so low on genuine psychological texture that viewers filled the void with their own interpretations. Compare that to something like The Morbegs, where the unsettling elements are actually there in the text. You don't need to invent a dark theory about The Morbegs. The burning tree is right there. The show is doing something strange on purpose.
That's the difference between a show that's actually unsettling and a show that's so bland it becomes a blank canvas for unsettling projections.
And I think this connects to a broader phenomenon in children's media criticism. There's a tendency to overread children's shows, to find hidden darkness everywhere. Sometimes a show is just a show. But the shows that attract the most overreading are often the ones that provide the least genuine material to work with. The blanker the canvas, the more people paint on it.
Rugrats is the Rorschach test of 90s animation, but not in a good way. It's a Rorschach test because it's empty, not because it's rich.
And The Morbegs is the opposite. The Morbegs is a Rorschach test because it's dense with meaning and different viewers pick up on different layers. Rugrats is a Rorschach test because there's nothing there, and viewers supply everything themselves.
Let's get into something specific. You mentioned the show had over 170 episodes. Were there any that actually broke the mold? Any strange or memorable episodes?
There are a few that stand out. There's an episode called The Mysterious Mr. Friend from Season 2 where Stu Pickles, Tommy's dad, builds a giant animatronic clown toy that becomes terrifying. The clown's face is frozen in this rictus grin. It moves in jerky, unpredictable ways, and the babies are frightened of it. It's one of the few times the show creates actual tension.
Animatronic clowns are always unsettling. That's not the show being clever. That's just tapping into a universal fear.
Fair, but the episode executes it well. There's another one called Chucky vs. the Potty, where Chucky has a nightmare about a giant talking toilet trying to eat him. It's played for comedy, but the nightmare sequence is surreal. And there's Angelica's worst nightmare, which I mentioned earlier, where Angelica dreams her parents replace her with a new baby. That episode gets into some real abandonment anxiety.
These are exceptions that prove the rule, right? A handful of episodes across a decade plus run.
And even the best episodes of Rugrats don't approach the consistent strangeness of a show like Ren and Stimpy, or the emotional depth of something like Hey Arnold, or the genuine folk horror of the Morbegs. Rugrats is a show that occasionally stumbled into interesting territory but never lived there.
The prompt mentions that Rugrats felt familiar, but lackluster. I think the familiarity is key here. Rugrats was on constantly. It was one of those shows that became background noise. You didn't have to pay attention to it, and the show didn't demand that you pay attention.
That's a really important point. Nickelodeon aired Rugrats in heavy rotation for years. It was always on, and the show's structure, 11-minute episodes, simple plots, clear resolution, made it perfect for passive viewing. You could drop in at any point and understand what was happening. You could miss 5 episodes and not be lost. That accessibility was a commercial strength, but it also meant the show never built the kind of cumulative weight that makes something feel significant.
Compare that to a show you had to seek out. If you watched The Morbegs, it was probably because it was on at a specific time on Irish television, and you sat down and watched it. It was a wallpaper. It was an event.
And that's not just nostalgia talking. There's a real difference in how we process media that demands our attention versus media that merely fills time. Rugrats was designed to fill time, and it filled it competently. But filling time is not the same as creating an experience.
Where does this leave us with the prompt's question? Why did Rugrats feel unappealing and vanilla despite being a show that many people, including Daniel, grew up with?
I think we've identified several layers. First, the characters are archetypes without depth. They serve the plot rather than driving it, and they don't evolve. Second, the visual style is distinctive, but doesn't serve any particular mood or theme. It's quirky branding without quirky substance. Third, the premise of seeing the world from a baby's perspective is rich, but the show rarely explores it beyond the most obvious gags. Fourth, the commercial optimization of the show, the heavy rotation, the merchandising, the mass appeal, sanded off any edges that might have made it memorable.
Fifth, the show was everywhere, which made it familiar in a way that breeds contempt rather than affection. Familiarity can deepen a relationship with art, but only if the art has depths to reveal on repeated exposure. Rugrats didn't.
That's the key. Great children's entertainment rewards rewatching. You catch new jokes, notice new details, appreciate different layers as you get older. Rugrats is exactly the same show at 30 that it was at 8. There's nothing to discover because everything is on the surface.
Which is actually fine for what it was. Not every children's show needs to be a layered masterpiece. But the prompt isn't asking whether Rugrats was adequate entertainment for a 6-year-old. It's asking why it feels hollow in retrospect. And the answer is that it was designed to be consumed, not to be remembered.
I think there's one more angle worth exploring. Rugrats came out in 1991, which was a transitional moment for children's animation. The 80s had been dominated by toy commercial shows, He-Man, Transformers, G.I. Joe. Rugrats was part of a wave of creator-driven animation that was supposed to be different. The Nicktoons were meant to be the alternative, and in some ways, they were. But Rugrats, despite its auteur origins at Klasky Csepo, ended up being just as commercial as anything from the 80s. It just sold plush toys instead of action figures.
The medium changed, the merchandise changed, but the underlying logic was the same.
And I think children can sense that even if they can't articulate it. There's a difference between a show that exists because someone had a vision and a show that exists because someone saw a market opportunity. Rugrats started as the former but quickly became the latter.
If we were going to place Rugrats on a spectrum of 90s children's shows, where does it land?
I put it right in the middle. Below it, you have bad shows that are incompetently made or actively harmful. Above it, you have shows with real artistic ambition. Ren and Stimpy at its best, Hey Arnold, the early seasons of SpongeBob before it declined. Rugrats is the median, it's the baseline. It's competent, professional, occasionally clever, never offensive, never transcendent.
The no hypothesis of children's television.
That's a perfect way to put it. Rugrats is what you get when you remove all the variables that make a show interesting and keep all the variables that make a show functional. It's the control group.
Which actually makes it useful as a reference point. If you want to understand why a show like The Morbegs is memorable, you can compare it to Rugrats and see exactly what Rugrats is missing.
The Morbegs has a specific cultural and folkloric context. It's rooted in Irish mythology, it has a sense of place, it has visual and atmospheric ambition, and it's not afraid to be unsettling. Rugrats has none of that. It takes place in a generic American suburb that could be anywhere. The only cultural specificity is Angelica's occasional Yiddish phrases. Her mother Charlotte is implied to be Jewish, voiced by the late Cheryl Chase, who brought some of her own background to the character. But that's a tiny detail in an otherwise contextless world.
That contextlessness is part of the vanilla feeling. The show doesn't taste like anywhere. It's the plain yogurt of children's programming.
I'd say it's the unflavored gelatin. It holds its shape, it does its job, and you forget you ate it 5 minutes later.
Let me ask you something. Do you think Rugrats would be remembered differently if it had ended after 3 seasons instead of running for over a decade?
That's an interesting question. The original run was 1991 to 1994, then it went on hiatus, then came back in 1996 with a slightly retooled look and new episodes. Then it kept going until 2004. If it had ended in 94, it would have been about 65 episodes, a respectable run, but not the behemoth it became. I think it might actually be remembered more fondly. The early seasons have a slightly rougher quality, a little more willingness to be odd. As the show went on, it became more polished and more formulaic.
The success diluted whatever modest virtues it had.
That's often how it works. The longer a show runs, the more it becomes a product rather than a creative work. The edges get sanded off, the formula gets locked in, and the show becomes a machine for producing content rather than a vehicle for expressing ideas.
That machine produced a lot of content. 3 movies, multiple spin-offs, a reboot in 2021 with CGI animation. The franchise is still going.
The 2021 reboot on Paramount Plus is interesting because it actually tries to address some of the criticisms we've been discussing. The animation is CGI, which removes the classic Sisupo weirdness entirely. It's much more polished, much more conventionally attractive, and the writing is a little more character-focused, but it's also even safer than the original, if that's possible. It's Rugrats with all the remaining rough edges completely smoothed over.
The reboot is even more vanilla than the original.
Which is almost impressive. It's like they looked at the original and said, "This is too edgy, let's dial it back."
What would an unvanilla Rugrats even look like?
That's a fun thought experiment. Imagine Rugrats where the baby's perspective is alienating, where the adult world is not just misunderstood, but actively threatening, where the show commits to the idea that being a baby is existentially terrifying. You can't communicate, you can't control your environment, you're completely dependent on giant creatures whose motivations you don't understand. That's a horror show. And the pieces are all there in the premise. The show just never went there.
It's almost like the premise is too dark for the execution, and everyone involved knew it, so they kept everything light and safe to avoid confronting what they'd actually set up.
That's a really sharp observation. The premise of Rugrats, taken seriously, is the premise of a psychological thriller. Babies navigating a world they can't understand, surrounded by beings they can't communicate with, facing dangers they can't articulate. The show chose to make that charming instead of unsettling. And charming is fine, but it's also forgettable.
Charming is the path of least resistance.
Rugrats always took the path of least resistance. That's its defining characteristic.
To answer the prompt directly, the show felt familiar, but lackluster, because it was designed to be familiar and lackluster. It wasn't a failure of execution. It was a success of a particular kind. The kind that prioritizes broad appeal and commercial longevity over artistic distinctiveness. The characters were archetypes without depth. The premise was rich but unexplored. The visual style was distinctive but hollow. And the show's omnipresence made it feel like wallpaper rather than art.
I'd add that the lack of cultural specificity is a big part of it too. The Morbegs is unmistakably Irish. Rugrats is unmistakably nowhere. It's a show that could have been made anywhere, by anyone, for anyone. And that universality, which was a commercial strength, is an artistic weakness. Great art is specific. Rugrats was generic by design.
That's not a moral failing. It's just a choice. But it's a choice that has consequences for how the show is remembered decades later.
If you want to make a show that a generation of children will watch passively and then struggle to recall specific episodes of, you make Rugrats. If you want to make a show that haunts people into adulthood, you make The Morbigs. Both are valid approaches. They just produce very different outcomes.
The prompt writer ended up a fan of the game version because the game actually delivered on the premise in a way the show didn't. In the game, the baby perspective isn't just a framing device, it's the gameplay. You experience the world as oversized and strange because you're navigating it as a baby. That's more immersive and more memorable than watching babies have mildly amusing misunderstandings for 11 minutes.
The game made the premise real. The show just gestured at it.
There's a lesson in there somewhere about interactivity and immersion, but I think we've been heavy enough for a show about cartoon babies.
But I will say, I think there's genuine value in analyzing why certain children's shows stick and others don't. It's not just nostalgia. There are real artistic choices that determine whether something becomes part of your mental furniture or fades into the background.
The shows that stick are the ones that respect the fact that children have rich inner lives and complicated emotions. The shows that fade are the ones that treat childhood as a cute interlude before real life begins.
Rugrats, for all its commercial genius, treated childhood as a cute interlude.
That feels like a good place to land.
I think so. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the early 1500s, Portuguese traders brought salt from the African Sahel to Newfoundland cod fisheries, where it was used to preserve fish for the European market. This unintentionally made Sahelian salt a critical input to the transatlantic cod trade, linking the economies of West Africa and North America decades before the Columbian Exchange was fully understood.
Global supply chains before globalization was a word.
Salt cod diplomacy. Thanks to Hilbert Flumentop for producing. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. We'll be back next time.
Until then, may your children's television be more Morbegs than Rugrats.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.